and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Welcome back, listeners. This is Simon Ward from the Triathlon Coach Swatcast, and today I've got some real special guests. Yes, that's right. You heard me. Guests are joining me, the plural. I have Brent and Kyle Pease joining me all the way from America. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
All right. Thank you for having us, Dan.
Thank you.
So if you don't know about Brent and Kyle, you may have seen some videos or some footage of them competing in triathlons, most latterly in Kona last year. Brent is the guy who does the cycling. Kyle has cerebral palsy, but they do the sport together. They're not doing it separately. They're a bit like Ricky and Dickie Hoyt. One won't exist without the other, won't do the sport without the other. And today we're going to talk with them about the amazing journey they've had. And also, I'd like to start off by talking about the new book that you guys have got out. So would you like to tell us what the title is and how you came up with that title? Maybe you can start off, Kyle.
Yeah, absolutely. The name of the book is Beyond the Finish, and it gets a look into our journey from the very beginning when we were children and all the way to Kona. I guess that we navigate life and that we... how our parents never took no for an answer, and how Brad got back into shape and entered into the triathlon more, and how I was enthralled by what Brad was doing, as well as all the other athletes, and how we got started with our journey.
Fantastic. Whose idea was it to write the book then?
It was a combination of both of us. I think that it was a long process. It took about 2 to 3 years for us to get the project out. But we wanted to let people know the stories behind the stories and give people some inspirational reading.
Does Mike Riley's just released a book? I think you might play a part in that one. Does he feature in your book at all?
Oh, he's absolutely. When we actually go out and speak, he's a bigger part of our speaking presentations as well.
Okay.
So yeah, no, I think everybody who does Ironman, if they were to write a book, I think Mr. Riley might have a very nice place in that narrative.
Well, I'm just writing my book, and it's called The Long Road to Kona. That's about my journey, and Mike certainly plays a part in that one as well. So, hopefully he doesn't expect royalties from all the people that are including him in their books.
Exactly.
So when did you first get the idea then, Kyle? You mentioned 2 or 3 years. Is that how long you've had the idea, or is that how long it's taken you to write the book and finish it off?
Well, really, Kyle wrote a children's book back in 2013. And, you know, kind of going through that process, we said, well, you know, at some point we kept calling it our big boy book. We said at some point we would really like to see what it's like to do a big boy book. And we at the time had made a connection with a guy named Todd Siven, who helped write Rick Hoyt's last book. And so we started asking him questions about, you know, what is the writing process like and how hard is it? How much time does it take? And, you know, he offered to help us whenever the time might come for us to write it. And then really the more we talked about, the more we realized it was going to take us with the coordination between, you know, me and Kyle and getting Todd to help us and getting our parents interviewed and all of the pieces that need to come together. Notwithstanding the fact that obviously we wanted Kona to be a part of that story. So we said, let's get the book written now. And whenever Kona might finally happen, that can be a part of the book as well. And so in 2016, we started working on the book and were able to finish it. Or late 2015, excuse me. And then obviously we finished it up December of 18 and then started the edit process and the telling us everything we did wrong process.
It's harder than training, right?
I'd rather be training for an Ironman, I can assure you.
Yeah, there's the same, if not more, discipline to making sure that every day you've got to be contributing something to the book. Otherwise, nothing gets done, does it?
And yeah, exactly.
Was it Tom or Todd? Did you say Todd Simmons?
It was Todd Simmons.
Was Todd the one who kept you accountable then and pushed you along and gave you a little nudge in the back to say, have you done another chapter yet?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think we all need somebody to be accountable, like a writing coach.
Yeah, and that's essentially what Todd was, and he's been a good friend and a great resource to us.
Yeah, okay. So, and did you do the writing yourselves then and then send the work to Todd for editing, or did he interview you and then write the book on your behalf and then you read it back afterwards?
You know, it was a little bit of both. And you know, so Kyle types about 10 words a minute. So it takes, he says he's a hunter and pecker on the keyboard. he's smiling at me now, making fun of him, but, it takes him a little bit longer. So we had a lot of combination of everything, but Kyle and I are actually really proud that when it got down to the end, we wrote a lot more than we thought. We really felt like when we started talking to Todd that he was going to be the one to help us figure out how to do a lot of it. But we felt like we put in as much work and that a large part of the writing process did ultimately fall to us. So, it was just really a combination, especially because we wanted our parents involved in the project. You know, my wife has a little bit of writing herself in there, and there's just so many different perspectives because the book really covers the full journey of our entire life, especially the early part of the book is really Kyle and my parents and just you know, learning how to deal with a child with a disability. And, you know, Ironman wasn't even a conversation in those days. And so just getting all that stuff coordinated and, you know, figuring out how it all fit nicely into a story. You know, I think that was really the most challenging part is figuring out where everything went and how to put it in there. And that's where Todd was instrumental of, you know, here's how we're going to kind of build the crescendo and, you know, help lead towards that final finish line or that ultimate prize.
Yeah, I guess a book's going to be a bit like a race, isn't it? Starts off slowly. You have some highs and lows on the way. You know, there's some amazing bits. There's some not so amazing bits, but then as with being in Kona, you know, you have that final hurrah that's the final chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we were waiting on. We had the book complete for the most part, and once we got into Kona, that was the final piece. So we always knew that we wanted to end on a Kona chapter, so it was very fitting the way it ended up this past October.
Okay, well, let's go back. You know, I mean, I've not read the book yet, guys, but I sure will once we've chatted. But let's go back and talk about those early years then. So, Brent, you're the oldest, right?
Correct.
But by what? A couple of years, is it?
Yeah, two years older.
Okay, so that's the same gap that I have with my brother.
Okay.
To be quite honest, when I was growing up, he was an irritant. I didn't want to spend much time with him, and I tried to do the opposite of what he did.
Sure.
How was that for you and Kyle?
Well, you know, after years of therapy and figuring it all out, I for whatever it was, and it's hard for me to fully appreciate or comprehend what it was, but I felt an instant connection to Kyle. And I think some of that was certainly just wanting to be a helper and wanting to understand, you know, what was going on in our family. And because at the time, I think what we all acknowledge now is that it felt it, in those early years, it just felt like this tragic thing that was happening to us. And so all of us processed that differently. My parents processed it one way, you know, Kyle had a twin brother, has a twin brother, sorry, who processed it differently. And so did I. And I think the way that I processed it was to protect and care for Kyle, maybe in the way that a caregiver or a parent might. And so there was just always this connection that we had with each other and, you know, wanting Kyle to be along. It, you know, certainly might have been different had he been able to run and keep up with me versus me having to help carry him or push him. There was a now famous video that we've uncovered through this journey when we were kids of being in the little tyke cars and we've tied a bunch of ropes together. And so I'm pulling both of my brothers while I'm pedaling a bicycle and they're both in little tyke cars behind me. And it's funny watching that because you realize we've been doing it together for 30 plus years, that this has always been the way. So there's just always been a close bond. And then, you know, it grew into sports. We grew up in a house that, you know, we watched Sports Center here stateside and, you know, we watched all the different sporting matches, our football, baseball, basketball, just anything we could, you know, digest. And it became a common theme and bond for our family and especially for Kyle and I.
How many, do you have any sisters?
No, my poor mother got stuck with three very active boys.
Okay. So, and what about Kyle's twin then? Does he play a part in your triathlon experiences?
Yes, he played a part in the very beginning, but he slowed us up a lot. So,
he slowed you up a lot. Fantastic.
Yeah, so he's a big supporter of what we do with the Kyle Peace Foundation, and he loves to see what we're doing.
We're all very close. You know, it's just that Kyle and I have developed this piece and it's become a big thing. And we joke that he slowed us up. But, you know, Kyle is as understanding a triathlete as people that you've met and encountered in your career. You know, that he understands where my heart rate's supposed to be. He pays attention and he sees his heart rate. He understands pacing. You know, we just recently ran a marathon this year, our first real attempt at Boston qualifying. And, you know, Kyle knew exactly what we needed to be doing all day. He knew when to kind of pull me back and push me forward. And, you know, Evan, our other brother, was more into just enjoying the experience with us. And unfortunately, as we've uncovered, Kyle is quite the competitive athlete. You know, plenty of stories of him. He and I maybe even getting into it a couple of times over perceived exertion, if you will, in the middle of an effort. So he's certainly a part of all that we do. He would just prefer to scream at us from the sidelines with a cold beer in his hand as opposed to pushing a bike up Palani.
Well, everyone needs a support crew.
Absolutely. So,
you know. And clearly Evan's found his place, but I want to know who gave him his marching orders from the team. Was it you, Kyle, or was it you, Brent?
You know, there's a funny story that we were doing a 4-mile fun run with a group here that that does adaptive learning for people with disabilities. And Kyle went through their program, I guess, almost 32 years ago. So we always go back to their race. It's been important for us with our foundation. And Evan came out and ran with us one year, and he was a little out of shape. And about 2 miles into this 4-mile fun run, he told us he had to walk, that he couldn't run any further. So we obliged and we walked with him for a little bit. And shortly after, a man in his 60s, maybe 70s, with his shirt off and just chiseled, came power walking past us, grunting the whole way. And I think that's when we all realized we might need to go a slightly different path with this. And so that was when the pivot happened, that Evan became a much bigger supporter from the side, and Kyle and I tried to see if we could run a little faster.
So you said you did everything together, right, from an early age. So you were obviously riding and learning to ride your bikes together and all of that. But did you, was it always sort of swimming and biking and running that you were involved with, or did you do other sports?
Yeah, we did a lot of other sports. When we were little, I would be the umpire while Evan and Brett played baseball, and they would get upset with me because I was a bad umpire. Growing up, Evan and Brett played baseball, lacrosse, football, and a bunch of other sports. And my parents would always break me, and I would be on the sideline, be there, and I was the biggest cheerleader. And then as I got a little bit older in my teens, I played a lot of adaptive sports with other people who had similar disabilities to me. But it was never totally mainstream. It was always wheelchair in front of it. So it wasn't until 2007 that we discovered OVA for triathlon.
Ah, okay. So was that you that discovered that then, Kyle, or was it Brent who found the triathlon sport first?
Yeah, it was Brent. At first, because Brett was a little out of shape, and he had a good time in college, and just wanted to get back in shape, and wasn't living the best lifestyle at the time, so he discovered triathlon, and just started doing 5Ks and 10Ks, and built his way up to a sprint triathlon, and then a half Ironman, and then a full Iron distance in 2010.
But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't always endurance sports for us. I mean, we grew up, just kind of on the traditional path that, you know, kids here do, and so, you know, the outlets for Kyle, like he mentioned, were adaptive sports, and I did what other kids my age were doing. So I did the basketball, I did baseball, and, you know, we both just kind of followed those paths. You know, there wasn't the big internet machine. And so, you know, we certainly were aware of folks like the Hoyts, or really we were the only people out there doing it, but it never kind of stuck with us that that was going to be something we were doing. And it was really when I started just trying to get in shape. And having, you know, been a swimmer in my youth, I kind of slowly gravitated towards triathlon as a means to just, improve my fitness and my lifestyle, like Kyle mentioned. And that's, you know, when we started kind of converging and realizing there was an untapped resource for both of us to compete and to share in ways that we really truly had never experienced outside of our backyard.
So you just had the same progression through the sport that most other people have then, mm-hmm. You know, sprint triathlon, standard onto 70.3, but with the big goal of always probably doing an Ironman. And did you always have the idea that you might get to Kona one day?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think exactly like you said is, and Kyle's progression was the same. I mean, I had done an Ironman when Kyle was ready to do his first triathlon. And so, you know, that progression started all over. So we did a sprint. We did an Olympic, you know, we did a couple of halves, you know, we slowly built our way up. As soon as we did that first half and we really got a taste of the real endurance aspect of it. And that first half was just a brutal day for us. Our bike was not even close to what it was in Kona, in terms of everything. But we were so happy and so elated to finish and enjoyed it so much, even with a few sunburns to go with it, that, you know, yes, we immediately started talking about, could we finish Kona? Could we do Kona? And so it became it absolutely became the dream, the vision, the goal, all of it.
Since you started doing the sport together, then have you ever done a race separately, Brent?
You know,
do you do all your position now with Kyle?
We used to keep one race kind of for each of us a year. So we're, you know, Kyle would go run with a really good friend of his who had been watching and supporting, and I would go do one race by myself as well. But I've got little kids at home and our foundation has gotten bigger. And so now we really just race together. It's easier for us to manage and, you know, quite frankly, we just enjoy it more. So the last solo race I did was, I did do one in 2017 actually, but for the most part now it's just, we're out there together.
That was always the big thing for, was it Rick? I can never remember who's the older, Rick or Dick, but, you know, the father was always asked if you can go this fast pushing his son, just imagine how good you could go on your own. And he always said, I don't want to do it on my own. That's not the point. You know, there wouldn't be anything there for me.
Yeah.
Doing it on my own. Is that how you feel now about doing this stuff, that you just get more joy in it and satisfaction out of doing it together?
Well, any perceived athleticism or any abilities that I've gained over the year are a result of my experiences with Kyle as an athlete. I don't know that I would have gotten to this level without him. And I have learned, especially in 2017, that I can do more with him. I'm a much more complete athlete when I have Kyle with me. And I think he would agree with me. He's nodding his head at me now, but we're both better athletes with each other. Kyle says it well, that, you know, it doesn't work without me and it doesn't work without Kyle, you know? So the parts equal a much greater whole for us. Maybe one day I'll want to go attack another one by myself, but I think for now I enjoy trying to see what Kyle and I are capable of together, versus apart.
And when you say a complete athlete, I'm assuming that you're talking about the emotional part and that side of things as well, not just the fitness.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you know, as good as any, and I'm sure many of your listeners do as well, that, especially in this sport, it's not always the fittest and the strongest who prevails, but the one who can mentally endure and mentally prevail, can sometimes, it's what makes this sport so great. It's not just a, race to see who's, you know, more fit or genetically gifted, or, you know, who has the tools that the others don't. You know, if you're willing to outlast somebody, you might find that you can take away any of the advantages they thought they had.
Let's going back to that first triathlon you did then, the sprint. How did you prepare for that? Because I guess you were starting from scratch. You had no equipment. So what did you do in terms of finding out exactly what equipment to use? And actually, was that sprint event, was it an open water swim, or did you do something in a pool in a leisure center?
You know, it's funny. I mean, it's interesting because I don't know that we would ever train like we did for the first one. We trained together. It was actually an Olympic. I realized we did an Olympic first, then we did the sprint. But we were doing the St. Anthony.
Okay.
We were doing the St. Anthony's Triathlon in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is very flat. There's 4,000, 5,000 people that participate. It's a huge race every year. And so it just made a lot of sense for us to go down there, do something without a lot of hills. But, you know, the swim part, we didn't do a lot together because there wasn't a lot of great places, and swimming with a boat in a pool is not always feasible. What we did do on the swim training is we do this with our foundation as well, is that anybody who's going to do a triathlon, a long course triathlon, we take them to a pool and we flip the boat so that we know what the emergency action plan is. And we learned, and I'll come back to this, but we learned that Kyle, we had about 20 or 30 seconds to get to him, before, you know, we were in trouble, or before Kyle was in trouble. I spent a large amount of time with the swim training, though, of tying a 5-gallon bucket to my waist and pulling that. We've also since learned that that's a significantly amount more weight than what was needed. So I don't do anything like that anymore. The bike, there's a lot of great places here that are safe. And so we would go out and ride together. And that actually became really one of the most enjoyable parts of the training experience, because, you know, we did a lot of that as I was teaching Kyle about aerobic training, zone two, and all the fun joys of long course training. You know, we would sit there and get to have these long conversations together on the bike and explain to Kyle what was happening and what he was seeing on his bike computer. And, you know, it was just a great experience. And the run we actually treat like the bike, because to get our equipment, by the time we go, you know, pick it up and throw it in the back of a vehicle, we need to drive somewhere anyways. So, but we, you know, typically what we do is, you know, 10 to 12 weeks out from a race is when we really start spending more time together. I'm kind of constantly on a state of training. And then as Kyle and I get closer to an event is when we start putting in more hours together to get Kyle's mind and body prepared and to get us kind of on the same sheet of music.
You must have to be quite fit for these events, Kyle. Yeah. So what preparations do you put in individually for an event that you're going to do?
Yeah, you know, so with my therapy, I'm always fighting my body and with all the spasms and all that. So I have to make sure that, you know, I'm good and prepared health wise and it's physically and then my nutrition. I'm not a big water drinker during everyday life, but during triathlon, I see that really put a lot of focus on making sure that water is going down and I have a good plan of action with my food. So I guess and mentally, I guess always have to be sharp and really get ready to help Brett out in whatever way I can, because we both need to be engaged in everything that we do during the race.
Yeah, when you're doing an Ironman and it's taking you 15 or 16 hours, it's a long time to stay engaged. So you have to have a certain amount of mental endurance as well, don't you, to sort of stay sharp and be alert and to watch out for things for both of you. You talked there, Brent, about the swim training. I was asked to help a lady who lived in the Bahamas, somebody I think you know, B.A. Bernard, and she was attempting to do Kona with her cousin, Wynn, who has cerebral palsy. And so when we went to the Bahamas to where she lives, we tried swimming with a little blow-up kayak. But the problem is that when somebody was sitting in that, their bottom just made a huge big lump like a whale's hump, and it caused such drag that you never got anywhere. When we tried swimming with a little inflatable dinghy that had a bit of plywood in the bottom, that was much better because the bottom was flat and it moved a lot easier. But one of the things that BA had to impress on her cousin was that she had to watch her weight because you know, if she was a kilo heavier, that made a huge difference to the drag on the swim, but also the effort she was going to have to put in on the bike. Have you covered the same things in your preparations?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting dynamic, and especially with anybody, any person living with a disability, that there's, you know, there's obviously a lot more going on. And so particular to Kyle, he's a pretty skinny guy as is. And so, you know, telling him to watch what he eats or, you know, being mindful of it may not be the best advice to get him to lose too much weight, which might become a health risk. What we learned with Kyle over this is that we really just had to teach him better eating habits. You know, Kyle was used to maybe only eating two meals a day sometimes, and it was fast food. And so while he wasn't gaining or losing any more weight than where he currently was, he just wasn't fueling himself properly. And like you said, over the course of 15, 16 hours, when he's exerting himself too, you know, he really had to learn how to better take care of himself. So we actually hired a nutritionist for Kyle who would go out and go shopping with him to help him find different foods and meal prep options so that when he didn't have somebody to help him or he didn't have somebody that could put together a meal, that he could still eat healthy without going over to, you know, the closest McDonald's. And so that was really actually instrumental, I feel like, in Kyle becoming a complete athlete, that he started learning to eat, you know, multiple times throughout the day and fueling himself. And so what happened is it was not that Kyle gained weight or lost weight, but he became, you know, the most efficient version of himself, and he felt better. And so he was, you know, just every, you know, his typical day became easier, which allowed us to train more, which allowed him to do harder races. I mean, you know, we just talked about it and you saw it with BA. I mean, this Ironman is not easy for anybody. You know, there is nobody Rick Hoyt, you know, Wynn, who's sat in that boat or been a participant in one of these events, that's not working their tail off. And Kyle was no exception to that. So it's all of this has been very interesting for us to kind of help Kyle see that, because so much of what he did growing up, it just didn't involve that. It was pretty simple. You know, we're going to slightly change the rules. You're going to go play this sport. You're going to go hang out over there. And it was never the things that you and I started trying to learn or pay better attention to as we became more actively engaged in the sport.
Tell me about the bike you use and how's the one you use now, and how has that changed since your very first triathlon experiences?
So that first bike was a little over 400 pounds. I'm sorry.
Wow, that's 400 pounds. Yeah. With Kyle or just
with
the bike
and Kyle on it? No, gosh, no. If that thing weighed 400 pounds, we better have a motor on it. it had an 8-gear internal hub. excuse me. And the bars were up in my chest. It was the only way to get the steering column built properly. So what is that? 200 kilos or 190, 180 kilos, give or take. It was really the most fun we ever had, I think, because it was just finally doing something truly together and for us in the most inclusive way possible, that we weren't changing the rules or Kyle wasn't doing some adaptive sport. Not that those weren't good experiences, but you know, we slowly adapted it race after race after race. And that first 70.3 we did was in New Orleans in 2012. And we still had the 8-gear internal hub, but we had stripped some weight. We had made some adjustments to the bike, the bars, et cetera. And that bike split took us almost 5 hours. And I got off the bike or we finished the race and we told the mechanic that had been helping us build the bikes that there was no way possible that we would finish an Ironman, let alone Kona, with that bike. And so every year became this tinkering piece, to the point where we had it built with SRAM One by, we had the right gearing on there. We had some carbon wheels with specially built hubs, to support the weight. You know, we had all these special welds on there to allow for a SRAM One by system. Power meter installed, you know, two bike computers and all these fancy stuff. But we were always, you know, that was down to about 385 pounds. We were always thinking about Kona, and we were always thinking about what would we do if it's a very windy day. When we did Ironman Florida in 2014, we were facing wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. And it's still to this day the slowest bike split we've ever had. And because of those conditions, and so we were very scared of what Kona might throw at us. And actually, a gentleman here who, in his spare time, being an engineer, works on race cars. Last summer, he helped fabricate an aluminum seat that laid Kyle at about a 40-degree angle. So to take him out of the wind, a bunch of holes cut in it for cooling and aerodynamics. It also allowed us to remove the heavy foot plates to support Kyle's legs and the spasms that he deals with over the course of a bike ride. Taking another 20, 30 pounds off the bike, getting us down to 360 pounds. So everything's constantly being tinkered. And interestingly enough, I just called the mechanic this morning as we talked about tinkering some more for some of the other bikes that we use with the foundation. So it's been this slow evolution. There's no way we could have finished Kona on that original bike. But, you know, I look back at some of those pictures from those early years with really fond memories, because it was just so fun to be able to be out there together.
360 pounds. I'm just thinking of triathletes here. They've got bikes that weigh 10 kilos and, you know, they're looking to get drilled Dura-Ace to make it a few grams lighter. Yeah. You've stripped almost 10% off the weight and it still weighs 360 pounds. That's just phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, that's including our weight as well, of course. I mean, the bike itself is, it's still significantly heavy than what your average triathlete's riding in Kona.
Of course. I didn't ask what your functional threshold is, Brent, in order to be able to push that up. I mean, some of the races you've described are relatively flat, but Kona's got some long old hills, hasn't it? And they drag on for a while.
You know, I think Kona, you know, we did Ironman Wisconsin, but I feel like Kona was a harder bike course for us because of those long sustained climbs. you know, what's interesting, what I tell people all the time is that, you know, I don't have this crazy high functional, you know, FTP, but I can push a gear for a really long time. And that's what I've had to learn how to do. And so there's certainly cyclists out there that, you know, might listen and say, well, I'd love to do this and I'd love to push an athlete. And, it might be, ego crushing to Kyle and I, as we watch them, you know, pedal circles around us. But you know, so for Kona, our normalized power was 211, but we pushed that for over 8 hours, very consistently, actually one of the most consistent bike rides we've ever had. And it was the smartest Kyle's ever been in a race, that he, after 6 years and in his fourth Ironman attempt, you know, he had a deeper understanding of what we were trying to do. So he was watching the numbers like a hawk. He had instructions from our coach of really the, you know, for us, he knew Javi, climbing up to Javi was going to be the most challenging part of the day because of the length and duration. And so, you know, it's just interesting. Perhaps it is, you know, a really high FTP compared to what some people might do, but I've trained with people that can still cycle circles around me. So I think the stronger ability for us is being able to set it in the gear and push it there for a long time.
What comes to mind now is not just the uphills, but when that thing gets some momentum going downhill, and what's that like? That must feel quite scary. What, particularly for you sat on the front there, Kyle. Because if it's scary and you're holding onto the handlebars, you have some element of control. You're sat on the front there, and you're not doing anything with the brakes.
The first time that I'm gonna go downhill, I was very scared. But that was in our very first couple races that we did. In Kona, I actually looked forward to going downhill. Because the uphill would challenge us a lot, and the speed difference was very drastic. But going down, it was fun to get the wind in your face, to get some of the eyelid breezes, and it was a great day.
And how, what do you do about when you're overtaking people? Because clearly there'll be a few people overtaking you up the hills, but I guess with that weight, you're going to catch them going down the hills. Do you shout at them, or do you have a horn or something to let people know you're coming past?
We get shout and hope for the best.
Kyle has perfected the on your left scream. But you're correct, because a lot of people will pass us going up a hill, and then, you know, the momentum of two humans and the steel required to support them going down a hill. It's an equation that we usually win. You know, we've hit 42 on the bike before, miles per hour. Which is, to me, is still pretty scary, because you can just feel that steel starting to flex underneath you, and the bike gets a little wobbly because of the length of the steering cables. But like Kyle said, it's just an exhilarating experience for him now. As you've seen in pictures, you know, our goal was always to keep Kyle on the front of the bike, because we wanted him to feel like the cyclist, and we wanted him to have that experience. We didn't want him to, you know, be towed behind, or, you know, just be a passenger. You know, we wanted him actively involved.
I think that's key too, because we talked about earlier on the show that we wanted to really be engaged with one another, and me being on the front of the cycle has really helped a lot, and it has kept me engaged and helped me encourage Brett a lot of the way, because we all know that in our sport, we go through very highs and very low lows when they get low. And I guess be there for your brother and your teammate is something very important to the both of us.
I'm just thinking in Kona of that little hill. Well, it's not quite a little hill. It's quite steep down Palani right at the very beginning. You've been going for 20 minutes, then you've got that steep hill, but worse, you've got that sharp left-hand bend at the bottom. Did that cause you any issues there? Because you'd have been going quite fast down that part of the road.
We had to hold it back, unfortunately, just a little bit. We actually had an issue race week. We had some the gears kept skipping, and we had never had that in training. We had done one North Georgia mountain. So the North Georgia mountains where we live are the start of the Appalachian Trail. It's just beautiful. It's some of the best riding in the country, in my opinion. And we'd never been able to take Kyle up there. And when we took the bike up for a training session, we had a ton of fun, but we were having some issues with the gears starting to skip around. And what we thought it was that the design of our bike, the rear cassette was not pushing up against the hub and the spokes, you know, as a support system. And so it was kind of freestanding. And so as we would get some real power into the pedals and the torque onto that cassette and chain, it would wobble so much that the chain would just bounce around. So we added a special bracket and some additional welds to kind of hold everything together. And when we got to Kona in transit, those welds had broken. And I'll try to tell this real quickly, but I mean, truly, as luck would have it, we were sitting at the bottom of a hill over by Kona Mountain Coffee. And at the top of the hill was an auto repair shop that actually worked on wheelchair vans. And the guy there was so nice. He quickly fixed the welds for us, got everything working, wouldn't take a dime for his time. When we got out there and started pedaling, and what we noticed is that we really put a lot of torque into the pedals, even with those welds, it would still skip a little bit. And so there was two things going on then on race days. Number one, we had to really monitor our power going up any short, steep climbs. So, you know, basically everything but Javi. We really had to be careful not to go for us above 350 watts. We really tried to keep everything actually under 300 watts for the power. But then coming down that hill with a quick sharp turn, we basically let the bike get up to speed and then quickly hit the brakes and already had it in gear anyway. So we weren't able to put any extra pressure. So it was pretty nerve wracking, that part of the course. And I had ridden it earlier in the week just to make sure I knew what we were going to do. And then Kyle and I talked about it, you know, hey, this is what you got to do. You got to really be paying attention. There's going to be people all over the place. There's going to be bicycle. There's going to be cyclists all over the place. You know, we got to be really engaged here and not worry about what's happening around us, but worry about what the two of us are doing. Because the worst thing that was going to happen is we were going to be out of the race before it started.
I think that one of the things that you could tell from our conversation is I think the preparation had to really that took a lot of detail and focus. It Brent and I had to both commit to that. Just focus on each other and focus on nutrition and making sure that, you know, that we were having a good time. So the preparation that we did to Kona was so detailed and so on point that I really did that. Helped us get to the finish line.
Yeah, I mean, Kona's the big party, right? And you've got to put the preparations in to make sure you get to the race and get to the finish. But equally, you never know if you're going to go back there, and you want to make sure you enjoy every single moment of it and that you can remember every single moment of it.
Absolutely, that's what our coach highlighted to both of us as well. Just to enjoy the moment and enjoy being out there with each other and on the big island.
You don't get any dispensation from Ironman with finish times, do you? The same 17-hour finish time that applies in an Ironman applies to you guys as well, right? So if you'd missed the bike cutoff, like BA and Wynn did, they got to mile 85 when they did the race in 2013. If you turn up back in Kona and 10 hours 35, you're out. That's it.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I absolutely love about the sport, that I am held to the same standards as the pros and the other athletes as well. And that's how I operate in my life, that I want everything to be as normal as possible. So that's one thing that I absolutely love about our sport.
But you got to Kona, though, and I mean, it must have been hard to concentrate on the job of preparing like athletes, because you were already celebrities when you got there. You were on the Bob Babbitt show. I don't know what other appearances you made in that week, but people definitely knew who you were when you got to that start line.
Well, I hesitate to mention this, but they called me Princess Peas during Kona week. I guess I was a little bit of a diva, but so Danny Grable planned all of the logistics for a race, and Danny's a pretty amazing endurance legend. She holds a bunch of ultra cycling records. She did Epic 5 in 2016. And, you know, really, if you're doing something crazy, and for us, Kona was crazy because of it, as you mentioned, it was just everything. We weren't just going there to race. It was an opportunity to, you know, further the mission of the foundation. It was an opportunity to share our story in addition to racing. And that's a lot for anybody to handle. You know, there's a reason the pros shut down in the middle of the week, because they have to get in that mode themselves. And so I mentioned all that, and, you know, Danny likes to joke about, you know, that I was high maintenance, but she was exceptional at managing everything we were doing. You know, I remember finishing that Bob Babbitt interview, and everybody wanted to take all these pictures, and Danny started barking orders as soon as we snapped a couple of photos that Kyle and Brent had to go back to the hotel, get their feet up and start drinking water. You know, whereas instead of standing on the beach and taking photos for 20 minutes and then talking to everybody, I mean, there was almost between our training group here in Atlanta and then the other folks that were with us, there was nearly 70 people that were part of the kind of spectating crew from our Atlanta extended family. And, you know, they were a lot of them were there for that Babbitt interview. So Danny was phenomenal at just helping us understand, you know, the additional taxing of just what it was taking out of us, you know, that the final spend needed to happen on Saturday. It didn't need to happen on, you know, Thursday morning with Bob Babbitt. Whether, you know, as much as Kyle and I enjoyed that experience, it was the drill needed to be finished on Saturday.
Yeah, we were out there for a reason, and like Brett said, all the other great activities were awesome to be a part of, but there was a bigger race that we came out for, so we just wanted to focus on giving it our best on race day.
It's amazing the number of, I've been going out to Kona now for 20 years, and I've seen a lot of things and a lot of people out there in that time, and it's amazing how many people who've spent so much time and effort and money, you know, over the years, and might have taken them 10, 15, 20 attempts to get to Kona, and you see some of them almost throwing away their race day performance by, you know, just getting involved in every single thing that's going on and all that. You could see the energy just dripping out of them, so they're exhausted by Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Equally, you don't want them to not enjoy it, but there's got to be a sort of like a happy medium between experiencing some of the activities, but making sure that you've still got enough energy to get through that that race on Saturday, because as you've said, it's brutal, Kona, isn't it? There's additional elements that most people haven't put together in a race before. They'll have done one or the other. You know, you can come to Europe and you can do Ironman Lanzarote, which is supposed to be the toughest one in the world, and it's got hills and wind, but it doesn't have the humidity of
right.
Kona, and that's an additional element.
It's the stress of a world championship event. You know, you're a good enough athlete to qualify for Kona, you're racing against a field where there's only maybe three or four people that you're racing against, you know, to get that coveted slot. You know, you show up in Hawaii, and even if you're going to finish 100th in your age group, it is so intense. I mean, I've never experienced anything like it. And, you know, Kyle and I were, you know, basically shaking before the race. We could feel that intensity, and we loved it. Looking back, because both of us have yearned for that type of environment and to do it together, you know, truly to be out there in a world championship event. And so that was really powerful. And it's exactly like you said, you watch people all week that you get caught up in so much. There's so much excitement. And it's the crown jewel of this sport. And there's so many wonderful experiences and celebrations going on all week. If I were to do it again, I would, you know, beg Danny, or I would have somebody there to help us be more aware, because it would have been very easy for Kyle and I to get swept up in all the excitement and not remember the other piece that was happening and the most important piece.
And I think it's critical that we have people like Danny and people that are there to help us remember why we're there. And to focus on getting to the finish line. And I think that's what Danny and our parents and Evan and so many other people did for us during that week.
We've talked about the bike. Let's just talk about the chair that you have then. How has that evolved over the years?
You know, that's the one piece of equipment that really hasn't evolved that much. There's a company in Snellville, Georgia, which is just outside of the city. And a guy and his wife have a company that it's a machine shop behind their house called Eagle Sport Chairs. And they make chairs that are all over the country. A lot of the elite, you know, quadriplegics and paraplegics that are, you know, in the Olympics and in the, you know, winning the London Marathon are using Eagle Sports chairs oftentimes. So that chair that Kyle and I use, we've been using it at almost every race since, early 2012. We've added a few pieces of support equipment to help Kyle with some of the issues that he deals with physically. But for the most part, it remains unchanged. Somebody did buy us a set of Zip race wheels, which was very nice. And so that's been really the biggest change we've made. So, you know, Kyle, very much like what you've seen with Rick and Dick Hoyt, Kyle sits in a, upright position. And then there's bars behind, which allow me to propel the chair.
And Kyle, I'm interested to know when you're on the bike, or actually when you're on the water and in the swim part, and then when you're on the bike and on the chair, how do you stay hydrated and get your nutrition in?
We typically, I don't eat during the swim. I eat before, and on the bike is where I get most of my nutrition in. So Brett feeds me. And then I have a big old water bottle that is attached to the back of my seat, and I just go through 5 or 6 of those during the bike race. And then Brett or a volunteer assists me with my nutrition on the run. So we would go by aid stages. Brett will give it to me, or a volunteer will give it to me based off of my instructions that I give them.
Okay, so I'm just trying to work this out now. So you have a water bottle, but does that water bottle get changed then when you go past the feed station? Yes. And does that mean you have to stop then to change
yes.
that?
So every time we go by an aid station, it gets filled up, or prior to an aid station, Brett fills it up with one of his bottles that we have on the bike.
So we use the old speed fill system. So it had a bigger bladder for Kyle. Okay. And so I would grab bottles.
Yeah.
So the typical routine, especially at a race like Kona, was kind of like being on an airplane or following the instructions from airplane emergency. Get everything that I need first and then attend to Kyle's needs. We joke about the rapper story, but that's very true as to how it used to happen. And so now we're a little bit more scientific of, let me get all my stuff in and taken care of, and then we'll get you set up and situated. He actually, Kyle kind of will wait until he feels like I've gotten everything, and then he'll start barking orders at what he needs. So I would grab two bottles for myself and start pouring a bottle over my head to cool that core temp as best I could. And then, the nice thing about a 3-wheel bike for us is the balance. And so I can sit there sometimes with no hands and grab a bottle for Kyle to start filling his bladder, and then even pour fluids on him if he's really hot, as well, to help cool him off. So it's a pretty interesting process, and I think it's fun to watch. I've seen videos of us coming through, the amount of stuff that we grab at an aid station.
That's funny. Say, I'll look on YouTube and see if I can find one of those and share it on the show notes so people can see exactly what you do on race day.
I've got another one of our athletes I'll have to send you so you can see it. And it's pretty cool watching it.
That'd be great. Thank you. Say, Kyle, when you're on the bike, do you use gels for nutrition or do you prefer something more solid like energy bars or a homemade product?
Solids, gels.
I like them all. Gels are quick and easy, but I do like solids as well.
We were talking about it this morning, actually, because, of course, Kyle and I would still like to, or we know we want to continue enjoying this journey together. But, you know, I think probably the next step for us is really to kind of come up with a really nice custom blend for Kyle that kind of helps him deliver all the nutrition that he needs in a liquid form. Because Kona was the first race he really struggled getting nutrition down. And it showed up on the run for both of us. But it's never been an issue in our past races together. And I think part of it was having him down at a 40 degree angle. I don't think that helped. And on all our training sessions, we were spending so much time worrying about the bike that we would stop and talk and, you know, it gave him a chance to eat. And so that race stress changed things a little bit. And I think it also added extra pressure onto me, cause Kyle needs help. So I have to feed him, you know, and so I think we've never done it because it's a better, you know, there's better delivery systems, but now I think, actually looking a little bit more carefully. So I don't know if you saw gentleman Colin O'Brady, who just, hiked across Antarctica, actually with a countryman of yours as well. They were the first two people to ever do it solo. Wow. But Colin was writing in his social media posts about these little bars that he had made that were basically a full day's nutrition in one bar. And it kind of got me thinking of, could we have two bottles for Kyle, two big bladders, one that he uses for just regular hydration, electrolytes, et cetera, and one that is, this is exactly what Kyle needs to get through the day. And he's got to drink this whole bottle over the course of 8 hours to make sure he's getting everything he needs, which just might oversimplify. I mean, you know, I think you're probably picking up on it. You know, Kyle and I approach this thing just like everybody else. We're factoring in what we have to, which is two humans and what it takes to get them over the course of 140.6 miles.
I remember a drink called Spizzarinctum, which was
it's a good name
that they used to use. Yeah, I'll have to see if I can find it for you. But it was like a milky substance, but it was highly calorific, and a lot of the Race Across America cyclists were using it. But the only problem is it doesn't do very well in the heat. So I think you have to keep it cool. Because I'd thought about, you know, I remembered this and I thought about it myself as to whether you could have this as an all-day nutrition for certain things, but it goes off very quickly. So you have to, on the Race Across America, they have the RVs that are following them so they can keep it in a refrigerator and then just give it to the riders when they need it. But you know, that was a while ago, so they may have come up with a different formula. I'll see if I can find it and send you a link.
Yeah.
So let's go back to Kona then, because you know, you finished, you became the first. What sort of classification are you in? Is it push assisted? I've read
most running races call it push assist. Ironman calls it special teams.
Okay.
So we were the first special team since the Hoyts to finish, and the first pair of brothers to ever do it.
Okay, so let's just talk about the you swim and you bike and you run quickly. How long did it take you for the swim, and what was that experience like? Because I've seen Dick pulling Rick, and you know, and I remember seeing you guys going out training. And if there's any swell at all, that raft can get towed around and float around like a flag behind you, which must make it a lot harder.
Yeah. So the swim really set us up for a great day. We swam in 1 hour and 7 minutes, and we were running over a lot of other competitors. So that was good, but it really set us up for a great day. And the bike was good. It was actually the first time that I felt comfortable on the bike. Normally during practice runs, something would be a challenge, whether it was my neck or the shoulder. But for Kona, it really felt great. And we did the bike in 8 hours and 22 minutes and 3 seconds. it was quite amazing. It was great to be out there with Bray. And then for the run we had some challenges with nutrition and some GI issues. But we tackled those challenges and we overcame those together and we finished the run in 4 hours and 45 minutes. So that's a combination of a little over 14 and a half. To be a dad, it was 14 hours and 29 minutes even.
Wow. 14:29. So do you say did I catch you right? And you said the swim was an hour and seven?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Fantastic. That's an amazing performance. So what were you expecting in terms of the swim and the bike then? Did you think you might be nearer to the cutoff times or were you expecting to be?
Yeah, the bike cutoff's always a thing. And the wind conditions in Hawaii this year were not what they're capable of. Being out there longer, we got some wins that other people didn't experience, but the swim was significantly faster. We thought we would be close to an hour 20.
Right.
We had done an hour swim, seven swim once before, but that was with a wetsuit.
Wow. Don't spend too long telling people that the winds were quiet last year and it was an easy year. Cause everybody likes to tell their friends that it was the hardest year that ever was when they were in Kona.
Look, it's still the hardest Ironman we've ever done. That's for sure. But, So previously on our previous Ironman attempts, we were in the 850s on the bike. So we had a matrix that we had set up to kind of give us a better understanding of where we wanted to be, through each phase of the day, assuming a 119 swim. Anything faster than that, we considered bonus time. So we always, that's just what we talked about. And, being in the ocean with the boat, with no wetsuit, that's just where we thought we might be. The bike was significantly faster than where we expected to be. And I think, the bike design played a part in that, the mechanics and just the work they put into it. I think the fitness that we put in, and the time we put in played into that. I mean, I've never, personally felt that good on a bike, in an Ironman event. And, that absolutely played a big role and we were so fired up. I think actually biking that fast hurt us when it came time to run, because usually when we got off the bike, we took a long time to kind of reset, get in some extra calories and get moving. And we were so excited and so fired up, that we kind of took our excitement and ran, literally and figuratively. We just grabbed our stuff and took off and, it caught up with us about mile seven of the run course. So, that's Ironman racing and we assumed that the bike cutoff was going to be a thing. It had, the very first one we did, we barely made a cutoff. We were 2 minutes under the cut line. So to be that far under the cut line was pretty exciting. What I like to tell people now is that, Kyle was elevated to world championship status and he was, very intent on getting us across that line, in the most efficient and quickest manner possible all day.
Perfect. How long does it normally take you to get through transition?
Our crew was, we practiced, we'd never really practiced transitions outside of racing. So that was the other piece I mentioned early on. So, with the first time we flipped Kyle, we figured 20 to 30 seconds. So we flipped him in the boat again because we hadn't done an ocean swim in so long. And before we could get to Kyle, he was in such good shape and he was so strong that he was able to roll himself over on his back and essentially save himself, from any kind of thing happening. And I think that attributed to our faster swim because I never looked back at Kyle, except for the turn. When we made the turn, I checked on him. And so all I did was listen for him and I swam, where in previous races, there was always this just fear. And so, several times throughout, I might slow down enough to be able to get a full turn and look at him and check on him and, you know, everything about it. So T1 was 5 minutes, which we've never had a transition that fast. And T2 was 8 minutes, because they had us in two separate areas for T2 just because of the size of our bike. So Kyle had to go to the medical tent and I went to the PC athlete tent to change. But I mean, the crew was on point. Danny's husband, Jason, who's a former Marine, was in there, and he's just very, he's very purposeful and he's very smart. And our dad was in there. And so there was a ton of love and care, you know, between the two of them. They just did an incredible job of, you know, making sure everything was perfectly set up so that nothing was left to chance in terms of missing cutoffs.
Wow. So 14 and a half hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was it like when you finally realized, I mean, you were ahead of your schedule, then you start having some troubles, then you get out onto that long, long highway going out to the airport and the energy lab. And then you're coming back and you're in the dark and you can see Kona coming up and you've got that lost long hill up the top of Palani. But when you get there, you know, you're home and dry and you had so much time in the bank. That must have been like a victory parade going down Palani and around the back road there and down onto Alihi.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, like you said, it was a victory. And once we got past the energy lab, because I really struggled personally in the energy lab, and once we got out there, it was just so surreal. And our coach told us from the get-go, get to enjoy the moment. And that's what we did. We enjoyed it together. We got to the red carpet, and we just, one of the most special moments that I have ever been a part of.
How about you, Brent?
There's nothing like it. You know, coming down Alihi, you know, I'd watched it so many times. I'd thought about it. I mean, somebody asked me, a good buddy, and as I was talking about our ups and downs of trying to get into the race and the what felt like an eternity in the moments of, you know, not getting there. And I think many of the athletes that have experienced Kona can certainly attest to that. And the one thing that really kept me going was the image of coming down Alihi with Kyle. And when we were little kids, I used to kind of playfully slap Kyle's cheeks, kind of like a parent does with a, you know, with a baby, where they just, you know, they're so gobbled up in all the cuteness. And I did that to Kyle for years. I think sometimes it might've even annoyed him, but I mean, when, you know, as he was older and as we were coming through that chute together, all those images of being little kids together and experiencing tragedy and triumph and all the amazing things that have happened to us in our lives. And when we came through that and Mike Riley's voice was so loud and so powerful, calling Kyle a world champion athlete. And I looked down and I grabbed his cheeks and that, you know, it was such a powerful moment of all that stuff. And before I knew it, my feet were in the air. And Kyle screamed louder and louder with each little jump that I made. And it's something I'll never forget because I had a front row seat and I got to witness one of the most incredible athletic accomplishments, ever, truly.
It makes me think when athletes are pushing themselves to the limit on their first time in Kona, that sometimes that everything goes by in such a blur that they don't get to appreciate that moment as much as they might, you know, which I've had friends that have been, and I've had athletes that I've worked with and coached, and they can't remember half the day. They were going out there to get a personal best. But in doing so, they, you know, a lot of it's a blur, a lot of it's blackness because they were in a bit of pain or they had such a bad stomach or, you know, everything else was hurting. They don't remember it, and that's a shame for me. In, you know, the pursuit of a few extra minutes takes away a lot of the happiness they've been searching for.
Yeah, no, and we were focused on that. You know, I think one thing, and all of our previous Ironmans, we always stopped as we went through the shoot, and we high fived, we looked for friends, we looked for family, and I knew my wife you know, because of Kona, that my wife and my parents, our parents were on the other side of the chute. And those were usually the people we looked for first, because those are the people that have put in more time than any to help make this dream a reality for us. And so I wanted to get to them, and I wanted to share that experience with Kyle more than anybody. Because we had, you know, we had so many people that had been a part of the journey and come along with us that were there screaming for us. And I'm sure I would have missed, one or two people had we tried to find everybody in that crowd. I mean, and you know, the crowds there at the finish line, we've never experienced anything like that either. I mean, so intense at that hour, you know, all these athletes that are doing the race in 9-10 hours have showered and changed and come back to share in that joy one more time. And, you know, I wanted to share that joy with Kyle. So it's funny, because we didn't really talk about the finish. We were so intent on that bike cutoff. Every time we talked in training, we never even talked about, we wouldn't even allow ourselves to go there at times. And so there was a conversation we had after the race where we both kind of almost felt a little, you know, tinge of disappointment that we didn't stop, or that we didn't take in a little bit more. And when I shared that story with Kyle of seeing his face and grabbing him, you know, as if we were little kids still, I think it both became really clear to us that we gained and got everything we wanted out of that finish, because the first people that we hugged were, you know, was my wife and my parents. And like I said, those three individuals, I feel very confident saying more so than anybody, put in the time and the energy. For my parents, from day one, you know, these are what Kyle and I are doing are lessons that we learned from them, that they shared and that they taught us. And from my wife, since the minute she met Kyle, that she's allowed and supported the role and the friendship and the bond that we have, that's a big part of our family. And that's a big part of what we do. And being able to share that finish with them was pretty special.
Did you have any tears crossing the line, or did they come later when you look back and let the full emotion come out?
No, it was there throughout the finish line and beyond. The tears were, I mean, I really can't put it into words what that day meant to us, what it meant to our family and our friends. But what it meant to both of us, that Brett gave me a gift, to be a world champion. And, it's so hard to really put that into words.
I think you've done a pretty good job.
Thank you.
Both of you. And, I look forward to reading the book and finding out a little bit more about this journey. We haven't been able to cover it in as much detail as I think it deserves, but, you've done a fantastic job of articulating that journey and not just what it took physically, but what it meant to you emotionally as well and as brothers. But now you've done that and you've written the book, what's next? You've sort of conquered the world. There isn't much, or is there much left for you to do?
You know that's the hardest question now, because before, after we did races, everybody would ask us what would be next. And I will always say Kona, because everybody wants to make it to Kona. I think what's next is, we'll of course pick another race in the future. But right now we're going to focus on the Kyle Peace Foundation and our work that we do, with all the fine individuals, athletes and their families, and help them to be the best that they can be as well.
You don't fancy coming to Europe, Kyle, and doing a race over here?
I would love to. That's on my bucket list, so we'll see what happens.
We tried unsuccessfully to get into the London Marathon. They don't actually have a category for folks like ourselves. Obviously, they have a very big wheelchair race, but you have to be able to self-propel. So Kyle and I have not been allowed to participate in that. We've certainly done some good Google searches of what's available to us over there. And, you know, that's certainly there. There's going to be something big. And, you know, I think, again, we had spent so much time chasing that Kona snake that we never said, well, what do we do when we finally get there? And I think I'm actually glad that there's not this next thing, because I haven't stopped enjoying that experience. It was about a year ago that we got in. And so I'm still having, you know, strong memories and feelings and experiences about really all of last summer and fall. So at some point we'll be able to sit down and settle in and find something else. We enjoy this too much to what we've gained together, to just simply let Kona be the end of the road. But for now, it was such a big mountain to climb. We want to be able to stop and take it all in.
Well, there's one thing, Kyle, that Brent was saying, that you're pretty good at shouting passing on the left. You're going to have, if you come to the UK to race, you're going to have to learn a whole new phrase, passing on the right.
I know. I was thinking about that.
Very confusing for him.
Or maybe you could carry on with passing on the left, but if you go and race in France or Germany, you can just learn it in a different language.
Yeah. That's always a good thing to broaden your horizons.
You just mentioned the Kyle Peace Foundation. I know the proceeds of your book are going towards that. Can you tell us a little bit more about the work you do there?
So after that first race in St. Anthony's, Kyle had such a powerful experience at the finish line that he wanted other people to be a part of that as well. And so in 2011, we started the Kyle Peace Foundation with a mission of improving the lives of people with disabilities through sports. Last year, 72 individuals crossed 248 finish lines. And we actually were able to hire two people with disabilities to help support and grow the foundation as well. So everything we do is aimed at improving their lives. And really what we've learned is that it's helping give them the confidence and learning how to be included and be a part of things without the wheelchair being a stigma or the wheelchair being a hindrance for them. And we feel like for what the foundation does, the finish line is really just the beginning. And we're really proud of what we've been able to accomplish in what's really a short time. This is our eighth year doing this. And it brings us a ton of joy to be able to be a part of that as somebody else's experience, as they become an athlete, as they become something that they might not have ever seen possible.
Amazing. You guys are such an inspiration. I wondered if you could leave our listeners with just a couple of things, one each, to think of as they go through their own triathlon journeys. Kyle, over to you first. If you've got one piece of advice for people, what would that be?
That anything is possible, that there are going to be challenges throughout your day, but to just keep pushing forward and don't let anything stop you from achieving what you want. And you make your race day what you want it. So just keep motivating and keep pushing and really understand that anything is possible when you put your mind to it.
That's a good one. Thank you, Kyle. What about you, Brent?
Stopping is always the easy part. When you find yourself struggling, if you keep going, you'll learn amazing things about yourself and what you're truly capable of. And I've learned a lot from Kyle, watching somebody who's never given up and who's never stopped fighting. And so I encourage you that when you want to take a seat and make things easier, to take at least one more step forward and push forward just a little bit harder and find out what's on the other side.
Some couple of great lessons there for us all to think about and live our lives by. So listen, Kyle and Brent Pease, thank you so much. It's been fantastic chatting with you. I wish you all the success with your new book. Just remind me of the title again. I'll let you say it to the guys.
Beyond the Finish.
Beyond the Finish. Okay. So we'll put a link to that. We will put a link to the Kyle Pease Foundation. If you have any videos that you would like to share, Brent or Kyle, just send me a link to those on YouTube and I'll put those on the show notes as well. And once again, thank you very much for being guests on the show today. It's been absolutely fantastic to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much for all your time.
Thank you.
Okay, guys. Well, that's it. What an amazing conversation that was. I hope you've enjoyed it. Brent and Kyle Pease there, a couple of really inspirational guys. Thank you again for being my guests this week. I'll be back. I will travel the world through the internet to try and find you some equally inspiring guests for future episodes. But for now, enjoy the rest of your week. Bye-bye.
That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWOT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I've spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose, and for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swim run events. As a SWOT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year. And on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWOT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page, and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWOT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.